the Financial Sense Lifetime Income Program. Now, here's the Financial Sense News Team, Jim Poplava and John Loeffler.
Hi, everyone. I'm Jim Poplava, and welcome to this week's edition of Lifetime Income.
And greetings, everybody. I'm John Loeffler. And what we would like to do on this week's program is continue with a theme that you are going to discover will become more pronounced as we head into this year. And that is investment returns. If you listened to our program last week, we did a show called The Next 10 Years, High Risk for Boomers. And so we're continuing that thought. The thought this week is the 401k black hole, title of our program, because it won't just affect baby boomers, but all working individuals who contribute to pension plans. And you have to recognize that for most Americans, their two major assets are, number one, equity in their home, and whatever is in their pension plan. And retirement assets represent about 36% of household net worth, now approaching countrywide $25 trillion. So, how you invest in market returns could greatly alter your plans for retirement, or actually when you retire and what you do while you are retired.
It was really amazing, John. You just quoted two points there, that for most Americans, their major asset is the equity they have in their home, with about roughly a little over 50% of Americans, maybe it's close to 60%, own a home, and the rest of it is in their pension plans. And it's interesting because right now, as of 2015, we don't have the numbers yet for 2016, there was approximately $4.5 trillion in 401k plans, which have primarily replaced what used to be defined benefit plans at corporate America. What was interesting is over 53% of Americans have no 401k plans or pensions. 52 million Americans have a 401k plan. So pensions represent the majority of savings for most Americans.
Yeah, let me inject here too, and this is what I think the current administration is trying to address in some of its tax reform. One of the reasons this is true is that if you take all of the taxes that Americans are paying, I think somebody estimated the average household pays between 40 and 60% of its gross income in taxes one way or another. Because if you look at federal taxes, Social Security, the FICA taxes, state taxes, sometimes county taxes, property taxes, in addition to other county taxes, sales taxes, everything, taxes at the pump, you know, energy taxes. People are being taxed to death. And what's left over, Jim? There's nothing to invest. And that's why they have nothing to save.
Yeah, you really see it in a state like California, which it's interesting. I read a number of articles, John, that there's a shortage of housing in California. 7 out of the 10 most expensive places to live in terms of cities are located in California. And there was a big environmental attorney who was very successful in stopping housing developments. But when he saw the impact of what it was doing to housing, he has now flipped and is now a big proponent for getting housing built in areas to bring down the cost of housing. Housing is 2.5 times more expensive in California. I just recently returned from a trip to Phoenix to visit my family there. And John, I really notice it. The minute I cross the border and go into Arizona at Yuma to fill my car with gas, it's a dollar cheaper than it is in California, because California has tax upon tax when it comes to gasoline. Our property taxes are more expensive. Everything's more expensive. So to your point, pensions, which represent the major form of savings in this country, not everybody has it because not everybody can afford it. Whether you're a business that is starting out, you just may not have the ability to set up a pension plan for yourself or your employees. And what makes this interesting is there are 10,000 baby boomers retiring every single day over the next decade. And what we've seen is the returns of most people's assets outside of a lot of boomers are relying on Social Security and then whatever they put aside in the company pension plan. The problem is the returns over the next 10 years are going to be drastically different than the returns that they've seen, let's say, over the previous 10 years. Because since the bottom of the financial crisis of March of 2009, we've seen the stock market more than doubled. So we've seen double-digit returns. We've seen the 40% drop in housing prices. We're gradually making our way back to where housing prices were at the peak in 2006. We're still a little bit below where they were in the peak of 2006. So you take your average family, where are their assets? It's the equity in their home, and they've been underwater these last 8 years. If you take pension plans, well, depending on where you've invested, we've seen some great returns in this stock market despite probably the slowest economic recovery that we've seen since World War II.
Why is it then people such as, well, if we go to Bloomberg, say, for example, and some of the press, it's pretty limited right now, but they're already starting to warn investors that the next 10 years are going to look radically different than they've looked in the last 10 years?
Well, it's for two reasons. Number one, stocks have become more expensive. I mean, if you go back to the bottom of March of 2009, when the S&P got down to 661, where today it's at 2300. And most of that return in the stock market has not come from rising corporate earnings, a lot of which has been financial engineering. Most of that return, John, has come from an expansion in the price earnings multiple, meaning that investors were willing to pay more for a dollar of earnings. The second reason that they're citing is last summer, we hit the lowest point in interest rates in 5,000 years of recorded human history. And we're going to get here shortly and tell you what happens every time interest rates go up one full percentage point. Depending on how you're invested, you can lose double-digit returns. Now, one of the reasons that a lot of firms, and we're going to cite a study done by GMO, which is Jeremy Grantham's firm, is the S&P 500 PE ratio currently is selling at 17.3 times 2017 earnings. Now, remember, the earnings for 2017, since we're only in the first month of the year, these are estimates in terms of where they think corporate earnings are going to be this year. Now, they should be better with the financial and the energy sector improving. So what does a 17 PE ratio equate to in terms of a percentage? It means a 6% rate of return. If you look at the S&P, which is trading at 19.2 times trailing earnings, which means the last four quarters, that equates to a 5% return. And if you take the Shiller Cape PE, which is a rolling average of 10 years for the PE ratio, the Cape Shiller PE is 28.5. That's equivalent to a 4% rate of return.
You know, but Jim, every time you hear people talk, maybe you'll see advertisements. There are some things pushing planning software for retirement. And these usually run on some basic types of formulas, remembering that we predict the future by extrapolating the past. Typically, they're planning on 10% returns. But what I'm hearing you say here is that with the markets where they are today, especially with the elevated profit to earnings ratios out there, the PE ratios, we're not going to see 10% returns over the next decade.
No. In fact, one of the individuals that writes for our site on Financial Sense, Doug Short, has got a graph, and he shows the price earnings multiples in terms of the average, the mean, where they've been over, let's say, since 1900. And John, as we take a look at where we are today, this is the third highest level of valuation in the stock market in recorded history. The highest, which was 157% above the average mean, was back in the year 2000. And that was the highest in history. The second highest level of market valuations goes back to September of 1929, when the PE ratio was 32.5. Now, in the tech bubble in December of 1999, it got to over 44. Today, If you take a look at the Shiller PE ratio, it's 28.5. So this is the third highest period of time that we've seen the stock market this elevated. And so why that's significant is they never ring a bell when the market is at a peak. At some point, and it'll usually be triggered by the Federal Reserve, because every bear market, most bear markets have been triggered by the Fed. Every recession since World War II has been triggered by the Federal Reserve. So what we've seen is when you have these periods where the PE multiple gets as high as it is today, the third highest in history, it is followed by periods of low returns.
Well, show me some examples of that, because you're still hearing chatter on television about 10% long range returns. And this, you know, we got a contradiction here.
A good example, if you take January of the year 2000 until April of 2013, the stock market appreciated in that 13-year period 1.5%. The total return in the stock market for the S&P during that same period of time was little under 30%, because that includes the dividends you were getting from the S&P. So your returns from the stock market from 2000 to 2013 mainly came from dividends, but the total return in the stock market, including a small price appreciation and annual dividends, John, was 2%. So for a 13-year period, we didn't even come close to the 10% rate of returns. You only got 20% of what the stock market had returned historically. And this is something that we see in periods when you have high stock market valuations. And another example is what we saw happen in real estate. Real estate, usually in most periods of recession, real estate would go down slightly. But in 2006, housing prices hit their peak. And by 2010, home prices in this country were down 40% from their peak. So the point I'm trying to make here is whenever you get stock market valuations as high as they are today, and at the same time, in terms of what the Fed is about ready to do, is that it is followed by a period, an extended period of low rates of return. And another example I can give you is the return on bonds. For example, if we take Bond Fund of America, which is probably one of the oldest bond mutual funds, it was started in 1974. And just to give you an example, in the bear market that we saw in bonds that began in 1954 and ended in 1981, we don't have data going back for a bond fund, but Bond Fund of America started in 1974. By 1981, at the bottom of the market, it had lost 34% of its value in a period of 7 years. And if you take that same fund from 2013, when the Fed announced the end of taper, and everybody remembers the rumble in the bond market that year when 10-year treasuries went from 1.6 to 3, just as we saw last summer when the 10-year treasury got down to 1.3 and went up to 2.6 by the end of the year. From 2013 to 2017, the total return on Bond Fund of America was a negative 0.8%. The total return, which includes all distributions, was 9%, and the annual return was less than 2%, 1.9%. And this is why I think a lot of these pensions, that you heard Lawrence Kotlikoff, you've heard, I'm trying to think of the individual we had on our show from Harvard University that talked about the next crisis in retirement, because you have even CalPERS, which is still using 7% rate of returns. And last week, and we'll discuss it once again, the probability of making 5% in the next decade are about zip, meaning zero. And it's interesting because Jeremy Grantham, who's a well-known value investor that heads up GMO, basically he took a look at these historical averages when you have interest rates this low and you start a bear market in bonds, and also you have stock market this high. What are the rate of returns over the next 7-year period. And he does this, he rolls it every quarter in terms of what the expected returns going out 7 years, because Grantham has been getting more conservative, raising more cash, and getting more defensive. There was an article recently talk about he is experiencing outflows out of his firm because everybody is getting excited about the stock market, especially with the Trump rally. And that's exactly what you need, John, for a bull market to end. You need that euphoria and that excitement that comes in the final phase when everybody thinks it's good times are going to last forever. Everybody gets excited and they're all in. And we're getting a little bit of that when you take a look at investor sentiment now, which is extremely bullish and it's almost at a peak. But here's what you'll find is interesting. Grantham took a look at what were the rate of returns of different asset classes, given the fact that over the next 7 years, when you have high PE and low interest rates as we are now, and now interest rates are reversing and climbing. And what I'm about ready to tell you is going to shock you.
Well, let me guess before you do this, what are you going to tell us? We get like, what, 2-3% returns, which isn't really anything to write home about.
No, it's actually worse. According to Grantham, over the next 7 years, if you are invested in large cap U.S. stocks, your rate of return will be a negative 3.1% in large cap, a negative 2.1% in small cap, a positive 0.6% in U.S. high quality stocks. Those are what we call, let's say, our large blue chips, large institutional type stocks, 0.1%, international, 0%, in emerging markets, 4.4%. So if there's anything that's going to have a positive return over the next 7 years, it would be emerging markets. But if you're in U.S. stocks, expect a negative rate of return, very much like what you saw happen between 2000 and 2013. And it doesn't get any better for bonds. If you are in U.S. bonds, you could expect over the next 7 years a negative 0.6%. If you're in international bonds hedged, meaning you've hedged the currency, you could expect a negative rate of return of 3%. And a lot of that has to do with interest rates in Europe, Japan, and elsewhere are far lower than where they are in the U.S. For example, a 10-year German Bund is about 0.4% compared to 2.4% for a treasury. If you are in emerging market debt, your best return would be 1.5%, 0.1%. If you're in inflation-linked U.S. bonds, and if you are in cash, your rate of return would be 0%. Commodities such as timber would have a 4% return.
So this translates to the idea that if we're not going to get even 2-3% over 7 years, you can expect negative returns pretty much like we saw in the last decade.
Very much so. What has happened, we'll get to this, in terms of traditional diversification mix is like 60% in stocks, 40% in bonds. And there was another study, and we just seen this. People have no idea how much money you can lose in the bond market. When I got in the business, John, at the end of the 70s, the beginning of the 80s, we referred to bonds as certificates of confiscation. That's one of the reasons why we use individual bonds, because I can keep them short term and I don't have to worry about losing money if I'm in a bond fund. But if you have an increase of 1%, if you have a 2-year treasury, you would lose 1.9% negative return, 5-year treasuries, 4.7%. If you had tips, you would lose 4.6%. A 10-year treasury, you would lose 8.6%. And if you had a 30-year treasury, you would lose almost 18%. Because another way of looking at this is if you have a treasury note, let's say a 2-year treasury note today, which is roughly about 1.2%. And let's say that over the next year, the Fed raises interest rates 4 times, or let's say 1 full percentage point, that increase of 1 percentage point over what you own, you would experience a loss of 1.9%. So traditionally, we've always had this kind of diversification mix. If you look at it's almost ubiquitous in terms of if you're looking at investing in a balanced fund, a balanced ETF, they're usually split like 60% stocks, 40% bonds. Well, if you take a look at, for example, the financial crisis that happened between 2007 and 2009, I've illustrated this on the program before, your stocks might have been down, let's say, 40%, but your bond portfolio was up 10 to 20%. So the gain in your bonds was offsetting the losses in your stocks as a result of diversification. However, when you have stocks going down and bonds going down, then you get the double whammy. And, you know, for almost three decades, this has been the traditional model. If you look at a mutual fund that's balanced, if you look at asset allocation models, if you look at financial planning models that determine outcomes of savings and investing, they've used this 60-40 split. And that has been working. And the hope was, well, if the stock market was going down like it did between 2007 and 2009, well, your bond portfolio held its own and it was going up. The problem is, and this is one of the points that was addressed in last week's Bloomberg article and also the Grantham study, is you're starting with the lowest rates in history. So every 1% rise in interest rates leads to losses in bonds and then eventually in stocks.
So given now, you know, what we're discussing here, these are articles forecasting this type of probability. Let's switch to reality, however, where we are right now, because the Fed has completely changed its tune during this last election cycle, and it's raising interest rates. And we know that the indicators that they usually use to know when they've gone too far is they keep cranking it up until something breaks. That's it. There's no meter otherwise.
Yeah, one of the things that I wrote in my article last week on the website called The Inheritance is this is the first president who's come into the office that is not starting his presidency with the recession and starting his presidency with the Fed lowering interest rates. He is actually the first president that is starting his presidency with the Fed raising interest rates. And what is really alarming, and nobody's paying attention to this, and we're going to start hammering this home more often. In fact, we talked about it on the weekend show, is if you look at the U.S. monetary base, it has shrunk by 6.3% year over year. So you got the stock market going up, but the monetary base is shrinking. And since this financial crisis was over, we've seen the S&P more than double, despite anemic economic growth that has only averaged 2.1% over the last 8 years. And what is being called to task now, the Wall Street Journal is kind of indicating that the Fed is more political than you think, because a recent article in the Journal talked about last year, Janet Yellen, when she was holding her FOMC meetings, when she was on Capitol Hill in February and July, she was talking to Congress, we need stimulus. You know, we've done everything we could at keeping interest rates to zero, but we need stimulus. After the Trump election, Fed governors immediately start coming out and saying, we don't need stimulus anymore. Secondly, in their December meeting, they raise their interest rate hikes when there was no indication that the economy was heating up. And here's the dangerous part. For the first time in the last 2 weeks, we have seven Fed governors now talking about unwinding the balance sheet, because the Fed's balance sheet went from $800 billion to $4.6 trillion. So basically what's going to happen is as these bonds come due, the Fed has been reinvesting those bonds in new bonds, keeping interest rates low. Now, as these bonds come due, they hinted that as soon as the Fed funds rate gets to 1%, which would basically be one more rate hike, they are going to start shrinking their balance sheet. And we know what happens, John, when you shrink the balance sheet. It shrinks credit, it shrinks liquidity in the market, and you get a bear market. And as I pointed out in my article last week that I wrote on the site called The Inheritance, every single recession since World War II was caused by Fed rate hikes. So we are now in the middle of a Fed rate raising cycle, and all language coming from the Fed is they intend to be raising interest rates over the next couple of years. In other words, they're going to raisin and tighten until they throw us into recession and a bear market.
Well, you know, if that's the case, number one, I think there's going to be a war between the White House and the Fed of one form or another. That's on the political side. But let's flop over to investing. If that really is the case, the idea of passive investing where you take your money, you plop it into something like, an index fund or something, and then relax and watch the money grow and grow and grow. That's not going to work.
No. In fact, passive investing or index investing has become very popular. You see it in robo plans. You see it in financial literature. Hey, just stick your money in an index fund, sit back, relax, and invest for the long term. Well, as I pointed out, between 2000 and 2013, if you were in an S&P 500 fund, the S&P made less than a 1.5% gain in 13 years. Your total return with dividends was 2%. And that was before even index funds have fees of 0.25 point or 7 basis points. So your returns are less. So could this happen again in the future? Very much so. I mean, if you take a look at what Grantham is talking about in the next 7 years, where the market is today, with the Fed raising interest rates, where valuations are, where interest rates are, your rate of return from stocks and bonds is going to be negative. And it really becomes significant, John, when you talk about the rates of return that people are assuming that they're going to make over the next 5 to 10 years. And this applies not to just boomers who are heading into retirement. It applies also to millennials, Gen Xers, anybody that's putting money aside. It's going to affect their rate of return.
All right, show me what this is going to look like, because if you're looking out there, there's a certain amount of euphoria right now. Lots of assumptions that everybody is running on, that good times are here to stay, returns are going to be around 4%, etc. But you're saying this is time for caution because that may not materialize.
No, and as we pointed out last week, the assumptions that you make if you're planning for retirement, looking 5 or 10 years out, the assumptions that you use for your return can make a big difference. Let me just give you an example. Let's suppose you have $100,000 in your 401k plan. Let's just forget adding to it. At a 3% return, that $100,000 10 years from now would be worth $134,000. At 6%, it would be worth $179,000. At 8%, it would be worth $216,000. And at 10%, $259,000. So, I mean, just look at that, John. The difference between $134,000 and the returns that are used in a lot of programs for retirement of 10%, $259,000, there's a whopping big difference. And let me put it another way. Let's suppose you're age 50. You're putting the maximum amount in a 401k plan, which is $23,000. If you put $23,000 into a 401k plan over 10 years, meaning you would fork over $230,000 of your own money, that would only be $263,000 at the end of 10 years at 3%, $303,000 at 6%, $333,000 at 8%, and $366,000 at 10%. So there are going to be a lot of major surprises and a lot of disappointment here. Because right now, we are hitting record levels, and we're assuming that the world is not impacted by the things that have happened over the last 10 years. First of all, we have $20 trillion in debt. Second of all, we hit the lowest interest rate in 5,000 years of recorded history. So the way forward is up, meaning that interest rates are going to rise. Thirdly, we have the third most expensive stock market in stock market history. And so the problem is most of these retirement plans, robo plans, are using 10% returns for the stock market, 7 to 8% returns for the bond market. They're not using negative. What if instead of 3% positive, you have 3% negative, as Grantham is projecting, or negative returns? I think just like anything else, anytime you go through a bull market, there's always some kind of fad that comes into play. Right now, it's passive investing with ETFs. And I think, John, once a bear market starts, I think this passive investment fad is going to end, because I think if you take a look at what we're facing over the next 10 years, rising retirement population, which is going to put strain on the budget. The CBO just released a new study that's saying that the budget should go down, assuming no changes yet from Trump, over the next year. But starting 2018, the government's deficit will start to mount every single year all the way to 2030, is more boomers head into retirement, drawing on Social Security and Medicare. And nobody's talking about entitlements at this point other than Paul Ryan. So a lot of these things that we're talking about here that we want to do, stimulus, rebuild our infrastructure, rebuild the military, stimulate the economy, is in direct conflict with the Federal Reserve that is hell-bent now on raising interest rates and unwinding its balance sheet, which is, they've been called on the map by the Wall Street Journal, basically saying, you should have done that in 2012 and 2010, but you didn't. Now, I would disagree in 2010 because we were still just coming out of a recession. But in 2012, they should have raised interest rates. They didn't. It was an election year. They should have done it in 2014. They didn't. It was an election year. And they should have done it in 15 and 16. They didn't, because of a presidential election. Now, they are going to start doing it and shrinking their balance sheet. And that does not bode well for asset classes, either stocks or bonds.
And what all of this means, the day of just putting your money in some kind of a fund and watching it grow, those are probably over and will not be returning for any time in the near future over the next 10 years. And so you have to plan a different type of strategy.
I would say we're going to go from passive to active management, because I don't think people would be happy to experience what they did from the year 2000 to April of 2013, where their rate of return over 13 years was basically zero. You know, with a lot of people heading into retirement, I just don't see that happening.
For our guest tomorrow on the program on Lifetime Income, Chris Hennessy is going to be with us. How the coming tax law changes will affect you as an employee, an employer, or an investor or retiree. That's tomorrow here on Lifetime Income. And now time for our Lifetime Income case study. We do have slides on the website available to follow the conversation that's going down here. Yes, with all of the case studies, they are real life case studies, but we change the names of the people involved to protect their privacy. So what are we looking at? I'm assuming we're talking about passive versus active investing here.
Somewhat. This week's case is Marty and Taylor Nunez. Marty is age 57. Taylor is age 55. Both, given their ages of 57 and 55, hope to retire soon. Given Marty's life expectancy is 87, Taylor would be 92. Risk tolerance is conservative, with income with capital preservation. A little backgrounder. Marty's job was corporate finance. He's managed all their finances up to this point. He subscribes to numerous newsletters and watches many shows, financial shows, regarding the market to stay informed. He typically has been a buy and hold investor and is focused on the energy sector, given his knowledge and work experience, because that's what he does. He works in corporate finance for an oil company. Traditionally, he invests in stocks and commodities and has had little bond exposure and little stock exposure outside the energy sector, which is an area he knows real well as a result of his own profession working in the oil industry. Marty would like to retire soon, as many of his longtime friends and coworkers have retired in recent years. And one of his favorite things is deep sea fishing. And so he'd like to spend more time. His wife, Taylor, is a massage therapist. She's very excited at the prospect of retiring, but a little bit nervous about their ability to do so, since they've spent a lot of money fixing up their home, and also, like any parent, paying for their children's education. So it was one of the reasons they both came to us for a plan is, hey, how do we look? Can we afford to retire? And what does that retirement picture look like? What was important to both Marty and Taylor was, number one, can we retire? Which is a big question I think a lot of people are going to be asking themselves the next 10 years. Number two, what's going to be the investment strategy? They both know that to retire, they were going to need to change a few things. Would they be able to maintain their lifestyle? And then, of course, what about taxes? Looking at their budget, their essential budget was about $72,000, discretionary $38,000, total budget of $110,000, Marty's salary $112,000, Taylor's salary $52,000, so they had surplus of roughly $54,000. Taking a look at what it would look like retirement, they figure $60,000 for essentials, $25,000 for discretionary, so that budget would drop from $110,000 down to $85,000, roughly about a $25,000 reduction in spending. Social Security for both of them would be $58,000. Shortfall before investments, roughly about $28,000. Now, looking at their assets, looked pretty good. Their primary residence was valued about $470,000. Other real estate holdings, which were a rental, $100,000. Marty's retirement plan, $707,000. Taylor's was $45,000. Their joint cash account was $220,000. They had $416,000 in precious metals. And this is one of the problems that we had with Marty. He basically understood commodity investing, working for an oil company, which was why he was heavily invested in energy and heavily invested in gold. The problem was precious metals didn't produce income. And he had stock options on the company stock of roughly about $98,000. So total investment assets were a little over $1 million, almost $1.1 million. Total assets about $1.8 million, with liabilities about $100,000. Now, here's the interesting thing. If you take a look at how they were diversified, they had 24% in commodities, 1% in cash, 34% in real estate, and 37% in stocks. And what we took a look at is he had a concentrated stock position, mainly company stock and energy. They had not budgeted before. They just never thought about it because they always had surplus income with both of their salaries. No diversification of assets and insufficient retirement savings. Who would have thought having close to $1 million would be not sufficient? What we did is we started with their Social Security of $58,000. And we said, look, you can't concentrate everything in energy and precious metals. It's too lopsided. You needed a balanced account with not only blue chip type dividend paying stocks that can go up, and also short term bonds because interest rates were going to start to rise. But the difference would be the income would go up considerably versus where they were in cash, precious metals, and an energy stock. Total investment income would rise to $33,000. Total income would be $91,000. Less a budget of $85,000 would give them a surplus of $6,000. Now, what we did is we encouraged Marty to reduce his concentrated stock positions by exercising his stock options and selling a portion of the company stock held inside his 401k program. We also recommended that he eliminate all exposure to the energy sector inside his taxable accounts. The other thing we did is got them to come up with a budget, and we put a system in place so that they could monitor, okay, how well are we doing against what we're projected to do, which is what you want to do. It's what every corporation does. When they set a budget at the beginning of the year for revenues and expenses, every quarter they have to report their earnings, and then you try to monitor that. The other thing was lack of diversification. We reallocated their assets to include some exposure to bonds, and we reduced their concentration significantly in just hard assets. We also recommended that they increase their savings in each one of their 401ks because that would be their best tax planning tool because that comes right off the front page of their tax return. And we also recommended they were going to have to delay their retirement between 2 to 3 years, and especially if we could get them up to age 66, where they would get full retirement benefits from Social Security. So in this case, John, it was a situation because of, let's say, working knowledge of the industry. Everything was concentrated in hard assets and cash. And so we had to diversify out of that. And then also, I mean, you know, having almost 35% of his assets in gold did not make a lot of sense if you're going into retirement and you were looking for income, because, you know, we had to remind him over the last 4 years, gold has been a terrible investment. And he had to admit at one point that $400,000 was worth close to, you know, $700,000 before the big drop from 1900 to where gold is today.
Well, it's going to be interesting, Jim, to see with the Republicans controlling all branches of Congress right now. There are still some deficit hawks on the Republican side, but it's going to be interesting to see what kind of compromise will arise between the Trump tax plan and the House tax plan, all of them promising tax reform, especially for small businesses. So that's going to be interesting to watch, because obviously, as you've said before on Lifetime Income, the less you pay in taxes, the more you have to save for your retirement. Coming up tomorrow on the show, Chris Hennessy, how the coming tax law, speaking of taxes, how the tax law changes will affect you as an employee, an employer, an investor, or a retiree.
In the meantime, on behalf of John Loeffler and myself, we'd like to thank you for joining us here on Lifetime Income. Until we talk again, we hope you have a pleasant week.
You can subscribe to Financial Sense NewsHour in the iTunes and BlackBerry podcast libraries or at feeds.feedburner.com/FSM. Find more information about our guests at www.financialsense.com/newshour. Friend us at www.facebook.com/financialsenseonline. For our on-the-go listeners, you can access Financial Sense on your mobile device at m.financialsense.com. The Financial Sense News Hour is for informational and educational purposes only and should not be considered as a solicitation or offer to purchase or sell any securities. The investments, investment strategies, and investment philosophies discussed or presented on the News Hour each involve their own unique risk factors, which are not discussed on the show. Responses to listener inquiries are based on the personal opinions of James Poplava and do not take into account listeners' suitability, objectives, or risk tolerance. Financial Sense NewsHour and its parent company shall not be liable for any financial losses that result from investing in any companies profiled on or advertising with Financial Sense, or arising out of the use of any material on the NewsHour. Be advised that you invest at your own risk.